Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Well, hello, my friends, and thank you so much for tuning in today to my podcast. I guess I don't know if you really tune into these things like a radio show used to be when it was only on at a certain time, but since this is a podcast and this modern technology allows you to listen to this over and over again and also whatever time you want, that I guess it's a little bit different than tuning in. So I guess maybe we'll call it clicking in. I don't even know if that's a term. But I hope to put together a good show for you today and have you learn some things, and God willing, it's of value to you. I know I'm going to try my best, and hopefully I will be successful at that. What I wanted to talk about today is I wanted to start off telling you a little bit about our farm. As many of you may know, we raise fresh market sweet corn in New Jersey. We have a small farm operation, and we raise bicolor sweet corn. And people ask me, Ray, why do you raise bicolor sweet corn for? And I tell them I have no choice. I get a blue tractor and a green planter, so no matter what seed I put in the hopper, it comes out bicolor. That's only something a farmer would appreciate, right? A city person would not appreciate the brand loyalty that many of us have to the color of the equipment. And I think that is great. So we raise sweet corn, and we've done that for since 1978. The farm has been in our family since long before I was born, since 1954, but we started to raise sweet corn, fresh market sweet corn, in 1978. And I am not embarrassed to tell you is that we were not good farmers. And I was a young boy and working under the tutelage of my father, and God rest his soul. But like many people back then in many situations, we had a way of doing things, and however we did it, we did it, and we were very adverse to change. We were very adverse to anything that was newfangled. This is the way we did it, and sometimes we had good results, sometimes we had bad results, and sometimes we had results someplace in between. So, but that's just the way it was back then, and that is one part about years back that I do not miss. So many times I look back and I think that today we live our life looking in the rearview mirror, wistfully looking back how things were back 20, 30, 40 years ago instead of looking ahead through the windshield. But that aspect of life I do not look back longingly for, because we were not good farmers. And then what basically happened was that we depleted our soil over the years, and then as most small farm families, is that there gets to be a bucking of heads between the one generation and the older generation. And not until my father died, sadly, was I able to take 100% control of our farm and then run it the way I felt it should be run, or probably a more accurate way is recognizing that we're not having good success, and that we needed to change things. What the changes were going to be, I couldn't honestly tell you. But I just knew that whatever we were doing was not working. We had our soil was constantly moldboard plowed, and it would just rain on it, and it would get hard as concrete. You could have used it for a superhighway. And that was a problem. And people were telling us, well, that's just the type of soil you have, and you can't do anything about it. That's where the good Lord made you farm. And I really didn't want to accept that, because I felt across the road where a neighbor was farming, the soil was better. And I could not believe that 16 feet of paved highway, county highway, made a difference in the soil. But then what had happened was that farmer retired and that land went fallow, so I really didn't have much new data other than the fact that I remember as a young boy that his situation was different than ours. So on my quest to learn and to make our farm profitable and to be a good steward of what God has trusted to us, I wanted to learn everything I possibly could, and it was very confusing at times because we were doing everything wrong. So no matter where I looked and spoke to other people, then I also started to see that other people were doing things wrong, maybe in a different way. And then in 2013, I bought a new car for my wife, a Ford Fiesta with satellite radio. And she ended up not wanting it, so I had to buy her another new car 6 months later, a Ford Escape, which she's very happy with. But anyway, so I took the Fiesta because I was driving a 1998 Ford Escort that I had bought new and with 450,000 miles. It was a great little car, and it was time to update. So I took the Fiesta over with the satellite radio. And just at that time, on the satellite radio, rural radio came about. On, I think it was Channel 82 back then, and became Channel 147 subsequently. And there was a new show coming on the air. It was called Ag PhD Radio. I'm not ashamed to admit that we did not have TV, so I didn't hear it. When the free signal went away, our TV went away, and we did not have any TV, so I was not cognizant of Ag PhD on the television show. So anyway, I was kind of excited to hear about this new show on the radio, and I drive a lot for business, being a technical writer for magazines, both automotive and agricultural, so I'm on the road quite a bit, and I was enjoying that rural radio station. And then the Ag PhD show came on, and when I had the opportunity, I would listen to it, and I really became a fan probably after the first 5 minutes. But anyway, to get to the point of the story, back in 2015, I attended one of Ag PhD Soils clinics, and it was in Sikeston, Missouri in the winter, and I drove out to Sikeston, and I listened to everything that they'd said prior to coming out there to bring a soil test with you and what have you, and I was sitting there in the soils clinic, and the Hefty brothers were talking about nutrient tie-up in the soil, and they were also talking about base saturation readings on a soil test. And I'm sitting there in Sikeston, Missouri, in the first row. Any seminar I go to, I always get there first, and I'm always sitting in the closest seat possible, because if I made an investment in time to go there, I want to glean as much as I possibly can. And one of the brothers were talking about the relationship of calcium and magnesium in base saturation and how it would impact your soil. And they said if your magnesium ratio is too high to your calcium ratio in base saturation, that your soil would get very hard once it got rained on, a little bit of moisture. And I looked at my soil test, and lo and behold, the base saturation ratio of the mag and the cal was way off. We were very heavy on mag, and not really bad on cal, but just way too heavy on mag. But anyway, then and it was a eureka moment, because I saw that was what was going on, why our field was getting so hard, and why our water infiltration was poor, and emergence was poor, and all those other things go along with it. But anyway, another thing that they were talking about further, a few slides down, was a concept that I was aware of, had heard of, but I didn't really study it. I really didn't give it much thought. And it was called nutrient tie-up, and I'm sure all of you are much better farmers than I am, and certainly better farmer than I was back then. And this concept of nutrient tie-up really, really interests me. And they had this little chart. It looked almost, it was a bunch of lines, and with the chemical definition of, or chemical abbreviation of the nutrient, and you'd follow it, it was a circle, and you'd follow it along. It was a little bit confusing at first, but I understood the concept of what they were trying to represent. And what I had learned was that if you have an imbalance in your soil, then one nutrient can latch to another one, and even though it's available for the plant, that it's in the soil, but it's available there, but the plant is not able to take it in because of this tie-up. And I understood that to the level that I needed to for what I wanted to do, grow sweet corn, and I wasn't going to be an agronomist, but I understood that from that point on, I understood that there's this tie-up and you have to keep all the nutrients in balance. So that was a big turning point in our farm. But the thing I want to establish today in this podcast being that even though we think of nutrient tie-up in soil for crop production, believe it or not, there's actually tie-up in machinery, and specifically engines. And obviously we wouldn't call it nutrient tie-up. I don't even think that there's a term for it, so I'll call it engine tie-up. But it's not only with engines, it could be with any mechanical system, whether it's a meter on a planter, whether it's a sprayer, what have you, but it's easier to think about it in first terms about engines. And there is a tie-up that happens inside an engine, and it's a little bit different because the engine needs to work in synchrony and harmony with one another, just like the plant needs to be able to access all those nutrients that are in the soil and not be bound up. And there are things that can happen inside an engine. For instance, carbon deposits on intake valves and carbon deposits on the piston crown that will impact the engine in all different ways because it is getting, I'll say, tied up. But actually what's happening in that particular instance, if you have carbon deposits on an intake valve, it's actually wicking in fuel. So the delivered air-fuel ratio and the air-fuel ratio that the engine is actually seeing is completely different, which would be akin to having a nutrient in the soil, and then you do a tissue analysis, you do a soil test and a tissue analysis at the same time, and you find out that you have those nutrients there, but they're not getting into the plant because it's tied up for some reason. The same thing happens with an engine. You could have a fuel delivery or a ignition timing setting, and that is correct, but it doesn't seem to be yielding the results. So in crops, we talk about yield, whether it's bushels or whether it's tons or what have you, of the particular crop. And in an engine, we talk about yield also, but we don't call it yield. We call it either horsepower, torque, fuel economy, idle quality, all of those things are the yield of an engine. So that is what we are going to be talking about today in our special delivery segment, which is when our listeners contact us with questions on equipment. We have a very, very good, interesting question today about a listener from Oklahoma, and he wants me to explain pump cavitation. And that is something that happens to a centrifugal pump, and I will go over that later and answer his question for the gentleman in Oklahoma. And then we also have another question from a farmer in Michigan, and let me see where I have it here on my desk, and he's interested in talking about fuel injection cleaners. So we'll answer those later on. So let's now talk about engine tie-up, or specifically what I'm calling fuel tie-up in an engine. And this predominantly happens to gasoline-powered engines. It could also happen to diesels, but to a much lesser extent due to the combustion process that a diesel has and also the composition of the fuel. A diesel tends to make more soot, which is particulate matter, and that's basically the essence of what Tier 4 emissions predominantly control, that along with oxides of nitrogen. Whereas a gasoline engine has a propensity, just due to the nature of the fuel, the hydrocarbon-based fuel, to create carbon deposits in the engine. And these carbon deposits will actually tie up the fuel delivered to the cylinder. Now, in an engine, we talk about two different types of fuel. Not two different types, I have to correct myself. Basically, there's two different air-fuel ratios, and it is the mixture of fuel to air. There is the created air-fuel ratio, and then there is the delivered air-fuel ratio. The created air-fuel ratio is what the fuel injector or carburetor distributes to the engine, whilst the delivered air-fuel ratio is actually what gets there. Now, you may say to yourself, well, you know, if it's the carburetor or fuel injector, we'll talk about fuel injectors as it's a little bit easier to understand than with a carburetor at this particular point, but I will definitely visit that as the podcast goes on. So you have a created air fuel ratio, and that is the result of the fuel pressure, the actual size of the fuel injector as far as its flow capacity is concerned. Much like sprayer tips, they are all different injector sizes and spray patterns, and when they build the engine and design the intake manifold and the engine itself, they choose a certain type of spray pattern and a certain flow rate of the injector, whereas most injectors, depending upon the system that is being used to measure, whether it's an American system or a metric system, it could be in grams of fuel per second is one metric that is used, metric meaning a measuring stick. There's pounds per hour of fuel, and there's also cc's per minute. So they all correlate to be the same thing. It's the flow rate, just like you would have a nozzle, a sprayer tip with a flow rate 30 gallons per hour. You could have a 30 pound per hour injector, meaning that it will flow 30 pounds of fuel per hour into the engine. So the created air fuel ratio is a combination of the fuel pressure, the injector flow rate, and also the length of time or duty cycle in milliseconds, thousands of a second, that the injector is open and spraying fuel. If anyone has a pulse width modulated sprayer on their farm, like a Case Patriot AIM command system, and I know there's other brands now, but they can't come right to mind, a pulse width modulated sprayer, that's a fuel injector. So that ticking that you hear, tick, 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 is actually the same thing that you would hear in a fuel injector. It's the opening and closing and the pressure staying constant and the fuel delivery being shut on and off. Actually, as an aside to that, on most sprayers, agricultural sprayers, crop sprayers, they actually block the flow, the pressure, and they don't do it at the sprayer tip. But whereas an injector, the flow is constant, and they shut off the nozzle at the sprayer tip. But ultimately, it's the same result. It's being shut on and off and duty cycled. So you have an air fuel ratio that is created, and an air fuel ratio is a certain amount of parts of fuel to one part of air. So, excuse me. Now, if the engine is loaded up with carbon deposits, what will happen is that those deposits will either wick in the created air fuel ratio and not allow it to be delivered to the cylinder, or they will actually block the flow of it and have it wet either the intake manifold wall, the combustion chamber wall, or what have you. But ultimately, it is not allowing the created air fuel ratio to be the same as the delivered air fuel ratio. So it is actually tying up the fuel inside the engine, and it's a tie up that you cannot see, just like a tie up of nutrients in the plant. The plant will show it to you as a nutrient deficiency through either visually, at that particular point it's pretty bad when you see it, or through a either a sap test or tissue analysis, and you will see that the nutrients are not getting in the plant, that the plant is being starved for a certain nutrient. Well, that happens in an engine through carbon deposits. The fuel will be administered and en route to the cylinder, but the cylinder will never get the proper air fuel ratio. And when the proper air fuel ratio is not delivered to the cylinder, just like a plant cannot grow and yield properly, and as I said earlier on in the introduction to this podcast, the engine will not yield because its idle quality will be off, the power will be off, the fuel consumption will be off, everything, it will not yield. So that is what basically happens as the fuel gets tied up. Now, inside an engine, there's two types of deposits that are formed. They have what is called IVD, which stands for intake valve deposits, and there's CCD, which is combustion chamber deposits. Now, the intake valve deposits are those that form on the backside of the intake valve, and they are the result of either the fuel composition in the gasoline that the engine is using, and also if there is any oil leakage past the valve guide through a poor valve stem seal and a slightly worn guide, what would basically happen is that when you shut the engine off, that it will drip some oil down past the clearance between the valve stem and the guide, and that will land on the valve and then eventually ultimately land on the top of the piston. So that's IVD, intake valve deposits. On any engine with fuel injection, the intake valve deposits are very critical as far as absorbing the fuel from the injector, because the injector is right there. I should say has a great impact on the delivered air-fuel ratio versus the created air-fuel ratio, and it's of paramount concern, because when the fuel injector sprays, it actually is designed on a port fuel injection system, not a direct injection system. And a direct injection system with gasoline, which is called GDI, gasoline direct injection, and that sprays the fuel right into the combustion chamber, a la like a diesel, whereas on a port fuel injection system, that the injector is situated at the connection between the intake manifold and the intake port of the cylinder head. And the injector, what they would call the phase or the angle, the orientation of the injector, is designed so that the fuel sprays against the intake valve, and it uses the valve itself, its collision with the intake valve, to help atomize the fuel and break it up into small particles. On any gasoline engine, three things need to happen for the gasoline to be a suitable fuel. It needs to be atomized, and that means it's broken down into small particles, just like you have with a spray from an aerosol can, but it is still in liquid form. The next phase is that it needs to be emulsified, and that means the liquid fuel is mixed with air. And the third aspect that the gasoline must undergo, it needs to become vaporized, and that means that it changes from a liquid, albeit in very tiny particles from atomization. It becomes a gaseous state, or what we would say becomes rarefied. And the rarefied fuel is what burns. And when there's an engine is laden with IVD, intake valve deposits, what will happen is that those three elements that are required to make the fuel burn, the atomization, the emulsification, and the vaporization, all skew. And then once they all skew, is that you don't have a fuel, you don't have the proper amount of fuel, and or you have liquid fuel, albeit a minute amount, going into the cylinder and not burning. And the end result is a poor running engine, a lack of power, usually unstable idle quality, higher emissions, and greater fuel consumption. So that is intake valve deposits. The other deposit that's formed is called CCD, combustion chamber deposits, and those are carbon deposits that form and reside on the top of the piston, which is called the crown of the piston, and also on the surface of the combustion chamber on the cylinder head. So that's called CCD, and it's called combustion chamber deposits because actually the combustion chamber, even though the majority of it people think of it as in the cylinder head, which that is the chamber, the other part of the chamber is the crown of the piston. Because when the piston comes up the top dead center, the top of the piston, the crown, is the floor of the combustion chamber. Now, combustion chamber deposits can be formed from the gasoline also, and also from oil leaking into the cylinder, from past the valve guide and or a ring package that is worn. But historically, most of the combustion chamber deposits are formed from the fuel and also from oil coming past the valve guide, the valve stem seal and the clearance in the guide, as we discussed. If you have an engine that emits whitish blue smoke on startup after it sat for a while, and then that smoke dissipates and the exhaust is clean, that is the hallmark of worn valve stem seals. Because when you shut the engine off, the oil is hot and it's thin, and it leaks past the guides and goes on either onto the backside of the valve, if that valve happens to be closed, or leaks past the valve onto the piston crown. And as soon as the ignition occurs, as soon as you start the engine, that oil burns off, and that's why there's smoke for a few seconds, a bluish-white smoke. And traditionally, oil smoke is blue, but there's usually not that much oil there, so it transitions from a whitish blue, a light color. And then it clears out because that oil has been dissipated until the next restart in the engine. When it was shut off, that oil is actually dripping down. So if you have an engine that has a propensity to have this bluish-white smoke on startup, then you know for a fact that it is loaded with deposits. And it's going to be loaded with, in that particular instance, both CCD and IVD deposits. And that will impact how the engine runs and performs. And over time, will actually make the engine very lethargic and make you think that it's quite worn out. Now, the other thing is that, getting back to IVD for a minute, we have to remember that the intake valve is the gateway for airflow into the engine. And when deposits form, and these deposits could actually tent up to such a degree that it blocks a majority of the flow path, and that is common. It's common for it to happen. It's common for it to happen on a lot of foreign car engines. Back years ago, Mitsubishi's, Hyundai's used to have a real propensity to build deposits, and they would block off the airflow paths to such a great extent that the engine would basically be down maybe 50 to 60 horsepower and would hardly run. And this is also a common occurrence, not due to design, but due to use for a lot of utility vehicles on the farm. Because the other criteria that causes a lot of deposits, both CCD and IVD, are a lot of short trips, or short, what we would call in the industry, short duty cycle, and also many cold starts. When the engine is cold, the mixture is richer, and a lot of the fuel does not become vaporized, and that fuel has the tendency to then become a carbon deposit because it is not burned. And that is a real, real problem as some of these engine short duty cycle engines get older. So to recap this, we have IVD intake valve deposits, and we have CCD, which is combustion chamber deposits. Now, what can you do about this? Well, obviously, if you have a certain use cycle for a piece of equipment, a UTV or an engine on a sea tender or something, you can't change that duty cycle too much. I mean, you're not going to get out onto the fall lane and take your UTV and ride up and down every week for 60 miles. So, but what you can do also is you can try to limit the cold starts if possible, but we'll take that out of the equation because we have to assume that you're using that particular engine in the intent that it was designed for in that application. So what you could do is, the best treatment for this, or the best way to combat deposits, are to never to let them form. So you may say, how can I never let them form? You just told me they're going to form. Well, there's two simple methods. The first method is to use a gasoline that is called a top-tier gasoline, and that is a gasoline that has more detergent in it and has less of a propensity to build deposits. But what people get confused with top-tier gasolines is that they have most of the time, they have a detergent level in them that will help remove some deposits, but the better brands of gasoline will also have a chemical characteristic that will not allow them to build deposits at such a fast rate. But you know, since we live in farm country, we have to use the gasoline that we get. So let's scratch that off the list. That's you know, pie in the sky as far as I'm concerned. You're not going to ride around looking in Montana looking for top tier gasoline all the time to put in your UTV. So that's really not practical. But the other thing you could do, which is very practical, is you need to treat that fuel from when that engine is new, and I don't care what the application is, whether it's a road vehicle or a farm engine, treat that fuel on a prescribed schedule with a very good fuel injector combustion chamber cleaner. And I do have a question later on in my special segment, special delivery segment from Randy in Michigan. And I did choose his question this today because it does talk about injector cleaners. So I'm going to go into a little bit more detail later on. And what you could, you don't have to treat the fuel all the time. I mean, so if you treat one tank full a month for that particular application, or if you buy bulk gasoline and treat the bulk gasoline with a good injector cleaner, then that will keep those deposits at bay, and they will, and it will also remove the ones that have formed and keep new ones from forming. And it's really inexpensive to do that, and it's just a great preventive maintenance. You know, and keep in mind also that if you have a smaller engine, let's say you have a you have an engine on a sea tender. I'm using that for example, and it's a rope start engine. It's not an electric start. You know, once you get these deposits in these engines, I mean, they become a bear to start. They become a bear to run. I mean, any rope pull engine is compromised to begin with because the amount of signal in the carburetor to start fuel flow is not that great. And also, the cranking speed of the crankshaft when you're pulling it with the rope is not as smooth or as high a RPM as it would be with an electric starter. So by keeping these deposits at bay, you'll have an engine that is much less frustrating to start and will run much better. I treat all my fuel, my lawn tractor, my weed whacker, everything here on the farm, my leaf blower, it all gets treated fuel on a continual basis because it's not even, it's micro pennies a gallon to treat it, and it's a percentage of a penny to treat it, and I want a piece of equipment that runs without frustration. And as I said, it's, you know, think of it this way: it's like brushing your teeth. If you brush your teeth and keep your teeth clean, and you have good oral hygiene, then you don't have as many problems with your teeth. When you go to a dentist, you get a clean bill of health. If you don't do that, then what basically happens is that you end up getting a lot of dental issues. And it's all, and in life, as we all know, it's just like, you know, with farming, it's. You know, it's easier to maintain the fertility in the field than to try to mine it all out and try to put it back. And it's the same thing as far as carbon deposits are concerned. Now, you're getting back to this tie-up deal, is that keep in mind that once you build a lot of CCD, combustion chamber deposits, there is an adverse effect that beyond it wicking in the air, the created air-fuel ratio, is that that will make the engine more prone to detonate or ping, which we would call abnormal combustion, because of the heat that is retained in those deposits. And what's really interesting, as an aside to this, is that with combustion chamber deposits, at first they are what is called soft deposits, and they could actually be eradicated, blown out if you took the engine, for instance, let's say on a car, and you jumped on it on the highway, and you see all the smoke come out of the back. Those are the loose deposits, that they are still soft. They have not hardened yet, but over time, much like the good Lord makes a diamond in the ground from coal through pressure and heat, those soft deposits, if not removed, will actually become rock hard, and they will not come off that piston. And chemically, it would be almost impossible to get them off. Not impossible, you'd have to do what is called a piston soak chemical, which is a burdensome task because you have to get all the spark plugs out, pour this chemical on top of the piston, let it sit, pump it out, and redo it again. So you really don't want to get there. So much like you'd rather brush your teeth and not have to have your teeth pulled out or have cavities, and the same thing is with deposits. But once you've built those combustion chamber deposits on today's modern engines with electronic timing controls, is that it will see that in most applications, it will see that engine wants to detonate or ping, and it will retard the timing. So now you basically have a fuel delivery that's wrong, you have the ignition timing that's wrong, and everything in that engine is now tied up. And it's all tied up just like you would have fertility in the ground tied up in the plant, and you have a poor, poor running engine. And it's simply because this would be akin to having the nutrients in the ground and not getting into the plant. So you could think of this as base saturation for engines. So it's like a base saturation test for engines. So to recap all of this, you know, not to belabor you with it, it's, you know, intake valve deposits, combustion chamber deposits are formed by the hydrocarbons in the fuel, the natural hydrocarbons in the gasoline. Is that short trips create a lot short trip cycles where the engine doesn't get that hot and has a lot of start-stop cycles, has a propensity to build deposits. Any oil that will leak past the valve stems, valve stem seals, will build deposits, and many cold starts will build deposits at an exponential rate. It's going to affect every aspect of that engine. So just like that plant is tied up, the engine is tied up with these deposits. And it will impact on a modern engine with electronic timing controls. It will impact the spark advance curve. And it will also impact the created versus delivered air fuel ratio. Now, in the beginning, I said I was also going to discuss with carburetors. Carbureted engines, the same thing happens. With carbureted engines, especially if the carburetor is set wrong or the choke is kept on too long, that rich mixture will have a real opportunity to wet down that valve and allow those deposits to form. In some ways, believe it or not, a carbureted engine is slightly more forgiving of IVD than a port fuel injected engine, because the three elements, the atomization, the emulsification, and the vaporization of the fuel happens before it gets to the intake valve, whereas on a port fuel injected engine, it actually, a part of that, the phase change and also the emulsification is happening right near the valve. So believe it or not, the old school carburetor, the engine will still fall prey to all of the ailments that I discussed when they're carbon laden, but it is slightly more forgiving than a modern fuel injected engine. So on a port fuel injected EFI system. So basically, in essence, you can't change the duty cycle use of the piece of equipment, so then what you need to do is use a good fuel injector cleaner, and I specifically like the Chevron Techron Fuel Systems Cleaner, and I will discuss that in a little bit more detail in a minute or two in the special delivery segment, which we will get to right now. Alrighty, I have a letter here from Rich from Oklahoma, and he writes, I recently had a hydraulic pump on a hay barn go bad. The shop that fixed it said it may have been, cavitated, excuse me. I do not understand that. If possible, please tell me what that is. Thanks. Love you on the Successful Farming TV show, and I have read you for years in Hemmings Motor News and other car magazines. Well, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate you watching me on Successful Farming TV and also for reading me in the car magazines. That's if anybody has, you know, went to my website, you know that was a part of my life and still is, but my true love is agriculture and trying to help the American farmer with making their decisions in the farm shop much more effective. Okay, let's just briefly, and I just want to say that in probably within the next couple of weeks, I'm going to have an in-detail article on the farmmachinerydigest.com website about cavitation in pumps, pump cavitation, and that'll be under the Learn tab, and it'll be the Learning series, so it'll be a magazine-type article. Basically, but to answer Rich's question right now on the podcast, pump cavitation, that describes the formation of bubbles or cavities in the fluid that is being pumped or moved. Within the industry, we call it that you're moving the liquid, not pumping it. And what will happen is that if that fluid has entrained air in it, and or there is a restriction in that feed or pressure line, then what will actually happen is that the fluid will actually become elevated in temperature, whatever the bulk fluid is. So let's say a hydraulic fluid, use that as an example. I don't want to get too engineering on you and call it a bulk fluid, but let's say we're talking about a hydraulic pump, as he said. So what will happen is that fluid will actually become elevated in temperature, and it will actually start to gas, and it will create little bubbles, and those bubbles will implode on either on the metal parts of the pump, either the impeller or the housing. And this is very hard for a lot of people to grasp, but those bubbles, when they actually hit, they actually are traveling at the speed of sound, and when they collide with the metal surface, they actually have the ability to destroy it. And the sign of the hallmark of a cavitated pump is either pitting in the volute, the pump housing, or pitting or broken pieces on the impeller. And that, so those little bubbles actually implode on there, they collide and they implode, and the shock wave of that hitting those metal surfaces actually deteriorates it over time and destroys that pump. So that is actually what is happening in a simplistic way with cavitation. What is cavitation? What is the cause of cavitation? It is one of two things. The most common cause of cavitation is a flow restriction. So what's happening, think of trying to suck water or soda or a glass of milk out of a straw, and you're coming near the end and you're sucking, and you don't have, and you're sucking more air than you are liquid, and so you are aerating that bulk fluid stream, and you are also starving that flow path, and that creates excessive heat, because in every pump, actually, the fluid that is being moved, the bulk fluid, is also a coolant. It's meant to act as a coolant from the compression of the liquid in the pump cavity. So basically, whenever you have a cavitation issue, it's the most common cause is a flow restriction. The flow restriction could be on the inlet side or the outlet side, and or the feed to that particular pump is actually sucking air someplace. You could have, and this happens a lot of times on diesel engines, actually inside the fuel tank, you could have a rubber pickup hose or a pickup line that became porous, and when the tank gets low on fuel, it actually introduces air into the liquid stream, into the fuel stream, and they call that entrained, E-N-T-R-A-I-N-E-D. It's air that's mixed in with the fluid, and those bubbles will cause it to cavitate. So basically, in essence, if your pump, Rich, was truly cavitated on that haybine, before you put too many hours on that piece of equipment, you're going to need to determine why that happened. Because if you don't, it's going to take that new pump out. And if you were to email me at hotrodfarmer@thefarmmachinerydigest.com with your telephone number, I can talk to you over the telephone, and I can give you some areas to check that would be common for that. And because otherwise, you're going to wipe out that new pump, and those pumps are not cheap. And if you're going to get some hay out of the field, and there's storms coming, that's not a good situation. And also, once again, thanks for reading me in the car magazines, and for watching me on the Successful Farming TV show. Now, Randy from Michigan writes, it says, you often speak about injector cleaning chemicals in your articles. Can you explain what they do? Well, yes, and I was talking today, and that's why I chose this question, as I said, because it talks about deposits. Even though we spoke about combustion chamber deposits and intake valve deposits, there are also deposits that form on the pintle of a fuel injector, and those deposits impede the flow and impede the atomization of the fuel, the actual spray pattern. The easiest way for a farmer to think about it is think about your sprayer. And you're doing a flow test on your sprayer, and you also look to see at what pattern that the tip is putting out. Well, that's the same thing with a fuel injector. You need to have a nice conical pattern. And once deposits form from the gasoline and from carbon inside the engine on the pintle, the tip of that fuel injector, it is no longer atomizing the fuel. It is actually spraying in a stream. It would be akin to having a sprayer tip that the boom touched the dirt, how you hit a gully in the field and the boom went down and kissed the ground with it, and now that one tip is spraying a stream instead of atomizing. So what a fuel injector cleaner will do is chemically remove those deposits. But keep in mind, as I said, with combustion chamber deposits and intake valve deposits, is that if you let those deposits get too hard, you're not going to be able to remove them with a chemical. Those injectors need to be physically removed from the engine, and they use an ultrasonic bath where through vibration they actually, basically in essence, it's like cavitation, as we discussed just the question before with the pump. It uses little bubbles to go and break those deposits off. But the good thing is that you don't need to allow it to get to that particular point. Now, to answer your question, within the industry, you'll have two different types of cleaners. There's what's called a fuel injection cleaner, and then you'll have something that's called a combustion chamber or complete fuel systems cleaner. And the Chevron Tecron is one of the brands that come to mind, but there are others. The rule of thumb is that if the bottle is listed as a fuel injector cleaner, then that chemical flashes off at the tip of the injector and does nothing to remove intake valve deposits and combustion chamber deposits. If it's listed as a complete fuel systems cleaner, then it has a special detergent that will clean off the injector pintle, the injector deposits, and then the other chemicals, the components, will not flash off, and they will attack the intake valve deposits and the combustion chamber deposits. So think of it as modes of action as you would a herbicide. A fuel injector cleaner is one mode of action, and whereas a fuel systems cleaner, a complete fuel systems cleaner, is three modes of action. It'll clean the injector, it'll clean the intake valve, and it'll complete the combustion chamber / piston crown. So that's really what you want to do. Is you want to use a complete fuel system cleaner, and you do not want to let those deposits form. And if you keep those deposits from forming, basically that's chemically tuning the engine. Today's spark plugs on a gas engine last 120,000, 130,000 miles. My little Ford Fiesta has 130,000 miles. I pulled the plugs out of it. They look like brand new, and they had no wear when I measured them with a feeler gauge, and the air filter still looks new. So the days of the old, you know, tune-up are gone, but we need to chemically keep these engines tuned by keeping the deposits off the injectors, the intake valve, and the combustion chamber. So listen, thank you so much for listening today. I greatly appreciate it, and I greatly appreciate everyone that comes to the website and uses it as a learning tool. And I guess it's time now for me to hook up the gooseneck and hit the road until next week. But I want you to know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for America and her farmers and ranchers. You have a blessed day and be safe, and talk to you next week. Bye-bye.